Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. For your perfect workspace, living space or hideaway, timberliving.ie. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. Open your mind to a new way of living. timberliving.ie.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. I suppose as to be expected on a bank holiday weekend in August, there's no great uniformity among the papers as to what the big story is. The Business Post air rage, DAA goes to court, and then they have Ryanair boss Michael O'Leary reliably lashing out. Eamon Ryan is the most incompetent transport minister we've ever had, he says in an interview in there. Far be it from me to criticise Michael O'Leary's communication strategy, because it's got him far in life. But if everyone's an idiot all the time, then nobody's an idiot. I always feel if you're going to publicly call people idiots, save it up for a special occasion and then it has a bit of oomph. But at this stage, Michael O'Leary calling more people incompetent idiots, and it's just like there's Michael O'Leary being Michael O'Leary. I'm saving it up, and someday. The Sunday Independent, prospects for SFFF coalition boosted by latest poll. That's a poll they have inside, and they're basically saying this poll suggests that public support for a Sinn Féin Fianna Fáil coalition is now ahead of support for the current coalition, 39% to 36%. That poll suggests. We'll come back to that. The Sunday Times is leading with the story of Yousef Palani. This was the man who committed those horrific murders in Sligo last year. Sligo killer had hit list of targets found on Grindr. And the Sunday World is also leading with that story. I was on Monster's kill list, and this is a man called Anthony Burke. And Anthony Burke is a man who actually met Yousef Palani and did get slashed by him with a knife, but was very, very lucky, you'd have to say, and lived to tell the tale. The Irish Mail on Sunday, fury over RTE chief snubbed to watchdog. Backhurst tells committees he'll miss deadlines, and the committees are not happy about this. But I think Kevin Backhurst, look, I'm not going to defend the RTE management, and I have no brief for Kevin Backhurst, never met him. But given that it takes about 20 years to conduct any inquiry into anything in this country, him saying that he might not have it till October, is that a cardinal sin? There's various inquiries. Some of them don't, I was reading during the week, I don't think some of them have even started yet. It sounds like they have one bunch of people from whoever the consultant is, Grant Thornton, but that they're finishing up one inquiry before they go on to the next one. The Mirror is leading with gunman targets paramedics, ambulance crews are left severely traumatised after incident. And the Sun on Sunday, Ant and Rex storm, and Tony sparks chaos, and that is the flooding yesterday in Dublin. Now, our panel today, Lorna Fitzpatrick, is an account manager at the public affairs consultancy Instinctive Partners and is also a member of the Labour Party. Kieran Casey is a lecturer in economics at the University of Limerick. Sarah Carey is a communication consultant and Irish Independent columnist. And Declan Power is a security and defence analyst. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Lorna, you have picked that front page of the Business Post, Air Rage DA goes to court.
Yeah, similar kind of thought processes around Michael O'Leary and his quotes today at the front page of that paper. I don't think Minister Ryan is going to be left in any doubt as to what Michael O'Leary thinks of him as minister and the work that he has been doing. But then again, I'm not sure if that's, you know, I don't think the comments were helpful, but I'm not sure if that's necessarily what Michael O'Leary is going for there, or whether it is just to get traction, and he absolutely has got that. The story, I suppose, as we all know, is around, you know, the number of flights that are landing in between those kind of midnight hours and early hours of the morning, impacting on people living in the area. Now, it does seem as if DAA put forward a proposal back in December 2020, to shift away from the number of flights that are taking off and landing and moving towards this noise quota system, which seems to make sense considering, you know, there's been advancements in technology and developments and so on. So that
and was approved by Fingal County Council.
Approved, but it actually took till till June 2022 to be approved. So it took a significant amount of time for it to be approved in the first place, and now has gone to On Board Panola. So we all know what that means. It'll take a significant amount of time before any sort of decision is made there. And this seems to be a potential solution. I don't live close to the airport. I can't imagine what that would be like in those really noisy planes that were coming in for years and years. But they seem to say that there has been changes in that technology, that planes are now quieter, and this system has been approved by the Fingal County Council. But yet nothing is happening yet.
Fingal County Council, the same people who are saying to the airport, no, you've got 6 weeks to sort this out. Now, then again, Sarah, there are people who are saying their health is being damaged, their children aren't sleeping, there's all
right,
that side
too. Right, but Lurkin Allen's piece in the Sunday Business Post points out that while noise complaints to DAA have almost doubled in 2022 to just over 26,000, 89% of those have been taken by a single individual who lodges dozens of complaints against the airport operator on a daily basis. So you do wonder how many people really are being affected by this. So O'Leary, in his typical bombastic style, is saying both that you can't have local government setting national transport policy, and in the Sunday Times is saying that national aviation policy has been set by a tiny number of residents in North Dublin, and according to Lurkin Allen in the Business Post, it's been set by one. So, you know, it's hard to figure out what's really going on.
There are a lot of other complaints, yeah. It does seem bizarre, Declan, doesn't it, that Fingal County Council are now putting the proverbial gun to the head of the DAA, but that Fingal County Council actually agree that the system should be as the DAA and Ryanair and everybody, all the other aviation people want it to be, which is that you have two additional hours. It's 11 a.m. to 6 a.m. It's 12 to 6 instead of 11 to 7, and that it's done based on noise, which I understand it is at a lot of other airports around Europe because planes are much quieter now than they used to be.
Yeah, I think there's an issue maybe where Fingal County Council are kind of caught in a bit of a bind, that they have a statutory role here that they have to act on, but that they're looking for the bigger adult in the room to step in. And I think perhaps that's what needs to happen. I think there's a lot of common sense in what Mick O'Leary says, and I would say that in being a fellow Mullingar man, but you know, notwithstanding the kind of hyperbole he sometimes goes on with, when you read what he says and you listen to what Sarah just said there, you can't have national policy, you know, things of a strategic level being damaged to a point where the tail is wagging the dog. Of course, people's quality
like people's
of life
lives
has to be taken. No, I take that. But you itemised it, what it comes down to. We're talking about a few hours either end of the nighttime period. We're talking about changes in technology. And what I'm always a firm believer in is not looking at things in splendid isolation. What are they doing in other countries? What are our European partners doing? Is there a similar example that we can look at and leverage knowledge from? And I'm sure there are, and I'm sure that's the way out of this. Rather than digging trenches and getting stuck into a protracted issue where it's a very black and white, binary type of approach to it, we need to be a little bit broader minded. But what it also comes back to too, and it kind of links in with stuff that was being talked about this week after the national security or national risk assessment, we need to get a little bit more out in front of strategic objectives with regards to this country. And there doesn't appear to be the necessary apparatus at national level to do the horizon scanning, forecast some of this stuff. And I'm sure Kieran and other people who are in the academic world could see some of these problems on the horizon. But we don't seem to have the process where that's channeled through to the policymakers to make appropriate decisions.
And again, it goes to that governance issue.
Hang on a second, yeah. Sarah. So Kieran, I bring you in there. Are people in the academic community seeing these problems? Are you busy conducting experiments about theory rather than...
I wish.
Practice. God,
I'm sure others are. I wouldn't have the competence for either. The piece I kind of jumped at is gas because it's commercial content. It's in the Business Post. So it's Dermot O'Leary from Goodbody, and he's making exactly the same point. So he's talking, we're pulling in.
In an ad, it has
to
be.
Yeah, it's in an ad.
I mean, you would have thought that if Dermot O'Leary from Goodbody offered an opinion piece somewhere that somebody would take it.
But they said
pay for an ad and we'll put in your thoughts.
What we'll do during a climate crisis is put Michael O'Leary giving out about the fact that he's not allowed to do enough flying flights on the front pages for free, but then Goodbody putting in something of strategic importance to the state has to be paid for in an ad. So yeah, it's a really interesting piece. So he's kind of saying, and I mean, which is something I've been banging on about as well, for all the good it does, we're going to, in terms of windfall taxation over the next couple of years, going to be pulling in Department of Finance forecasts about $64 billion. It's actually incredibly close to the state bailout back in 2008, 2010, that kind of period. It's a phenomenal amount of money, and exactly what he's saying is right. So you invested, we're facing long-term strategic issues like ageing. We've awful...
Okay, we'll come back to the economy. Mm-hmm. Of course. Let's stick with the airport for a minute. Presumably that $64 billion is contingent as well on us, as Michael O'Leary would say, as a small peripheral island, having good connectivity to all these countries who are essentially our sugar daddies, yeah?
We don't know what it's contingent on. I mean, I think that's a good answer. Seriously, like, as in, you know, is it that there's a load of execs flying in from Silicon Valley, or is it the changes in the global tax rules?
Is it not our highly educated, brilliant workforce and our young people?
There was an amazing study done by UL colleagues 20 years ago, and I still always point to it because it's the one that goes, you're competing with other European countries. We got the multinationals here despite, at the point, historically underperforming education levels. It wasn't because they were brilliant. You're not competing with, you know, countries from all over the world. You're competing with Northern European economies, and our education standards are not. And again, it's all in the papers.
We speak English good, though.
We do speak English good. But someone said this, the two we were competing with were the English and the Dutch, and the Dutch speak English good too. They do. So, I mean, that's it.
Actually,
you know,
they speak English so well that I think their system is rebelling now, and they want to start having Dutch as the default language for their academic courses when it used to be English.
Okay, well, that'll take them out of the equation. Sarah, you wanted to come back in there just before we're bleeding into all kinds of stuff here, but I do want to keep some order.
Yeah, well, just back on the airport, you know, the point that Michael O'Leary is making, and it is a good point, is who is in charge of policy? So is it Fingal County Council?
Well, Lorna said it's in front of Plan All right now.
Is it the minister? So how can something like national aviation policy end up in local authority, you know, like, and that's the crazy point, and that goes across all policy areas, back to
a local authority who does not believe in this ultimatum they are presenting. They're actually agreeable to
who's in charge?
Well, I'm board Plan Ola right now, so how much confidence does that give us that this will be resolved?
Well, we know about the backlogs
fashion
that they're trying to get through, you know, and the tough time that they've had. So I think that's what's frustrating.
You'd wonder, could this be moved up the list for them, maybe? Texter says, I live less than 1.5 kilometres from the airport. There's no problem with noise. Someone else says, I grew up in Swords in the 70s when the BAA 111 would rattle the panes of glass in the window at takeoff and landing. You get used to it, says that person. Okay. And I'm sure, did you know damage at all in the long run? Kieran, you picked, it's kind of in conjunction with this, two stories on page 3 of the Sunday Times, both by Patrick O'Donoghue. Yeah. Wild Atlantic washout as rain ruins summer play, and winterwear flies off shelves in brutal weather. And you're contrasting this with the aviation story.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So front of the pages is Michael O'Leary going, isn't it terrible? We're not able to bring in enough flights. And in the inlay and the framing, there's an amazing book Steven Pinker writes, and he kind of goes, if you were writing a newspaper with a 30-year time horizon, like, look what happened over the past 30 years, and the front would be climate change. It would be this. You read the inlay of the papers and people are giving out, like, the climate's changing and things like that, and it's impacting our businesses, but it's not framed in the context of climate change. Mm-hmm. There's two guys running a business and they say, you know, part of this is down to, you know, poor government strategy around refugees in hotel beds, which prompts, why are the refugees coming here and why are they increasingly going to be coming here? And that's climate change. And
but I think, like, nothing is a simple issue either. Like, I mean, one of the immediate issues facing them in Westport does seem to be a shortage of tourist beds. Like,
absolutely.
So we give them that.
Of course,
like,
I'm not having all these things
are multifactorial.
It's not about having someone individually, it's more in terms of the newspaper framing, and it is multifactorial, and ultimately an awful lot is coming back to climate change. And again, what we're talking about in terms of long-term planning and mitigation, it's not down to just kind of, you know, oh, we'll chuck money at the problem now. It's like, well, what's your long-term time horizon, and how does this all piece together?
Do you believe we're not taking it seriously?
Climate change? No, absolutely not. Jesus, no. And I mean, it's scary. I mean, just, I think this summer is very kind of, it's very much evidence of that. It's very, I think everyone, this is hitting home a lot. And I know people are sick to death of hearing about it, but ultimately, I mean, across all the newspapers...
Those guys in Westport are pointing out. Now, I'm in no way, I mean, I think we're seeing it, there's no doubt about it and everything, but we bear in mind that there is an El Nino factor this year, which was predicted. Those guys are pointing out that it was at the second year of the pandemic, 2021, we had that glorious summer as well. So, you know, I mean, the trends agreed, but the weather does fluctuate here from year to year, and it always has.
Could I just throw in another point there, Brendan, as you said? I think one of the things that we're in danger of doing with regards to climate change is looking at it very much from specific perspectives, and there's the rural and the urban divide, and that is getting wider, and in my opinion it's getting wider because at times we kind of think the problem starts and ends in Ireland. We could turn ourselves inside out to be the best climate change pupils in the class, and if the big heavy hitting nations don't make serious changes, we can beggar ourselves and it's not going to make any difference, is what I'm saying.
That's true, but I don't think that excuses us from the fact that as a Western and as a Northern economy, we have to show that there is a different way to live. Not just a question of moral leadership, but it's showing how people can live differently. So getting on the bike, even in the rain, using public transport, the farmers, you know, going to have... And I live in the country, I actually live on a farm, having to accept that they're going to have to switch from productivity to biodiversity preservation. Yeah. And I think we're still in that sense of, oh, this is going to impact me, it's going to ruin our life, rather than change our lives, and in some ways for the better.
But you see, what Declan's saying about if we do too much and other people aren't doing enough, right? But if you take that on the more micro level then, and you're saying the farmers have to accept that they are become custodians of biodiversity or whatever, but they're going to point to people in cities and say their whole lives aren't being upended like this. So, and I mean, look, people are only human.
Well, they will, because people in cities, for example, are going to have to get out of their cars and move to public transport. So everybody will have to change the way.
Which isn't really on a par with changing your whole way of life and your business model and what you do and
everything.
But Brendan,
you don't have to.
Get out of the car, like.
But you don't have to change everything. You just have to change a bit. So take the biodiversity bit and rewilding, which I've been writing a lot about in my column, you know, over the past year. It doesn't mean changing everything. It means setting aside a bit of land, you know. It means changing from how you do your practices. And a lot of farmers actually are very aware of this and are doing it. I know the IFA has been very militant in its opposition recently, particularly in the last month. But a lot of farmers can see for themselves how the land has changed, how growth has changed, flowers are disappearing and things like that. And the CAP has responded to that, the Common Agricultural Policy. It is switching grants from productivity to preservation. And a piece I wrote a couple of months ago was talking a farmer saying about how the money is moving from the east of the country to the west. So it actually is happening.
But Sarah, that's one strand of it. Sorry.
Exactly,
And I agree with a lot of what you're saying there. It has to be done in an incremental way, but that's not how people are seeing it.
Exactly.
And so how this has been communicated is one part of it. But also, you're talking about a point, and you have a point when you say, we can't be childish about it. Yeah. But we can be childish about lots of other things and reconstruct it in ways that suit us. We do it with regards to national defence all the time. We do it with other things with regards to national security and even crime and policing. So we shouldn't be surprised that that can happen, arise in this area. We are doing strange things that I would say sometimes when we look at climate change. When it comes to our energy security, we made decisions that have impacted our ability to have an independent energy security stance in order to be the best boys in the climate change class.
This is not giving any more exploration licenses for oil and gas.
Yeah, and I, you know, at the time it happened, nobody saw the war in Ukraine happening. But was it the wisest decision? Did we do something? Did we do something that is damaging to us as a nation strategically, or has the potential to be, in order to, I don't know, to propagate our image? What I'm not saying is that your points aren't correct. I'm not saying I have the answers. I'm saying we need to look at it a little bit more critically, and we need to be careful about the decisions we make, that we're not doing a purely to virtue signal and do something that could have some potential damage to us in the shorter term.
And actually,
I want to bring Lorna in there. You were nodding there, Lorna.
I think it's important that these decisions and these discussions are evidence-based and evidence-led, and led by the scientists and the people who really know the ins and outs of what we're talking about here. I don't necessarily necessarily think, I don't think decisions should be made to virtue signal in any way, shape or form. But I also think that, you know, it's the younger generations who are going to be dealing with the consequences of our actions right now. And we've seen it with Fridays for Futures and with schools coming together and young people and students getting out on the streets talking about their concern over the lack of action on climate. And actually in one of the papers today, we see in the poll, I don't have it right in front of me here, but climate change is coming back up in terms of priority issues for people. And that's coming through because of what we're seeing at the moment in terms of across Europe and so on.
So if it's in front of our noses.
When it's in front of us. But I think that comes back to that point around communication and the way in which people are receiving information around climate is very segregated. Is, you know, it's in a box here and a box there, and when it's linked to specific stories, it's in front of people and it's at the fore of their mind. But there needs to be a better way of communicating with people about what the impacts are and how we can all take actions. It's not just about recycling
And bear in mind as well that while people say they're concerned about climate change, the Greens are on 3%. When push comes to shove, people don't want to do the things that they need.
I think the Greens are up a bit in the poll today. We'll come to that poll. Go on, Ciarán.
I think that's the biggest thing you can do personally. I could agree. I mean, you can, as the hybrid driving, quinoa munching person achieving very little, is, you know, on the doors, the biggest thing any of us can do is say, I am voting based on this issue. This is my top priority. It's not, you know, I want tax cuts in the next election. It's climate change for me is the biggest political issue. And that's what we can do. In terms of energy dependency, again, it comes back to the planning thing. It's, I think if we've 64 billion quid, you go invest in a massive renewable energy project, it gives us energy security, it solves the climate issue, and it's got an internally economic return.
I think we are intending to do that, but like everything else, it's moving very slowly. I mean, our renewables have definitely gone way up and continue to rise.
But people are still
it's a success story, but a very slow success story.
And people are still protesting against even something like a solar farm, which is relatively benign. You know, it's very frustrating trying to get people to understand that the gap between the abstract and the specific when it comes to doing what we need to do.
The Dermot O'Leary article, he's quoting the Fiscal Advisory Council say we've underspent by 15% on capital spending because of inflation and so on. Because that's what we do, that money flows in and we spend it, especially coming up to an election and all the polls, we'll spend it in current spending.
Okay, we'll come back to that. Now, I think that given that the whole panel was fairly kind of one-sided about the DAA story, I'm going to read some texts here from people who are obviously concerned about the issue. There's so much spin being put out by the DAA and Ryanair. The issue with the noise is the flight paths now from the new North runway do not fly over the planned routes, according to this text. They therefore do not fly over the noise monitors. Every departure currently overflies the three most populated towns north of the airport. It is not acceptable. That's from Brian. Check that, sorry. Someone else saying, should we just accept noise pollution the way we have to accept other pollution and say to hell with the ordinary people who are being inconvenienced by the rich getting richer? Whatever way you look at it, planes are very noisy. The Bray Air Show was irritating enough, and I live in Greystone, says that person. I live 6K from the airport, says this texter. Noise noticeably worse since new runway. Can hear engines powering up to take off. What, 6 kilometres away? Planning rules should be complied with. Your panel is not balanced. Hello, climate change too. And that, I'll just read one more, right? The residents are in favour of the runway. It's not being operated in a fair manner. If they change how they operate it, there will in fact be more departures. There is a simple solution if anybody is interested in listening. And then look, there are a lot of people making the point that Ciarán was making, I think, which is that we're talking on one hand about climate change and then we're talking about how do we get more planes in the air? What's the point of cycling everywhere and living on kale when at the same time we can't get enough airplanes in the air for our holidays and tourism? Why are these two things not being connected in the national narrative? That's from Sinead and Kildare. I think they are being connected.
And the other one is the cost of living crisis. People keep talking about this, and Dublin Airport have had their busiest month ever with people getting away for flights that are more expensive than they were a year ago, and issues on the continent where car hire is more expensive. So there are a lot of joining of dots that can be done in this story.
Well, I think what you would say about the cost of living crisis is that it's very clear that half of the population are experiencing a cost of living crisis and half of the population are not, and that seems to be the way it is.
But Brendan, just with regards to some of the comments there, I think what we probably are all saying here in the panel in one shape or form about it is is it, are the decisions about what is a national strategic issue being dealt with the right agencies and with the right tools? And I think we all agree that they're not. It's being micromanaged by entities that are not really equipped to be dealing with national issues. And nobody wants to see townspeople being bullied or their quality of life being damaged. But we need to look at it in
okay, so not for the first time, someone on the panel calling for joined up thinking, I think is the phrase here.
And a bit of horizon scanning as well.
Let's move on to another thing that's been exercising people for quite a while now, is the general area of law and order. But Lorna, you picked a piece in the Sunday Independent by Hugh O'Connell, McEntee feeling the heat after chain of events, where he's basically saying that Helen McEntee has had a run of bad luck kind of with events.
Yeah, and look, the reason I pulled this out is because one particular comment really got my back up, I have to say. But in general, I think this piece is very much kind of targeting Helen McEntee and saying, you know, that things haven't been going her way. Some of that is of her own making, I think, in terms of her own communications. But the reason that I pulled this out is because there was one person in particular who was quoted from a Fine Gael source, one party TD said that she is chaining herself too much to hate speech and the social airy-fairy issues and not sufficiently on law and order issues. Now, I was quite taken by that because I'd love to know what they mean by the airy-fairy issues. The things that Helen McEntee has really put on the agenda over the last number of months and years around domestic violence, around online bullying, around image-based sexual abuse, all of those issues that have, and the hate speech legislation, that have massive impacts on the individuals, and they are crimes. So they're not airy-fairy issues. They are absolutely crimes that haven't been getting the focus that they deserve.
Another security source says somewhere in that piece that actually a lot of people in law enforcement don't believe that there is an epidemic of street crime, but they do believe that there is an epidemic of domestic violence.
And
in
not
this
only
country,
do they believe
that it's much more serious.
Yeah, not only do they believe it, the statistics are there to back it up. So I'm not saying that the antisocial issues that we're facing are non-existent. Of course they are, and they need to be addressed. But it doesn't mean that the other issues that have been addressed through, the strategy to end gender-based violence, the domestic strategy, domestic violence strategy, the work that has been done around image-based sexual abuse, the legislation around stalking, those issues are real issues as well and are real crimes that have been addressed. And I don't think that it's fair to say that they are airy-fairy issues.
Okay. But Lorna, Sarah Carey, I bring you in, Declan, you wouldn't be unfamiliar with the Fine Gael gene pool, and there would be that old-fashioned law and order strand where they would think that boots on the ground and street crime is a more real issue than airy-fairy stuff around hate crime and the like, wouldn't
they? Yeah, but I think it's wider, though, I'd say, than just the Fine Gael constituency, that sense. Now, that was a very good point that was made in that piece, that gender violence, I think they said it's actually double the level of street violence, but I think what's done it for us is the row over the hate speech legislation. Yeah. Yeah. That not simply is she seen to be addressing something that people don't see as important as those other issues, including gender violence, but also that she's going at it badly. So you've got people like Michael McDougall, who is a former Attorney General, and who is pointing out that the drafting of the legislation itself is flawed. So not only is she seen to be tackling something that a lot of people don't think is as important as the street violence, but that she's going about it in a ham-fisted way. Yeah, so she's not
Doing. Well, let's not question her competence now. I mean, she didn't draft the legislation, and the legislation, some people think it's not well done, other people think it's fine. Declan, you wanted to come in there.
Well, just to amplify that point, and that's what I was going to say to Lorna, that I don't think, when the comments about the airy-fairy aspect, I think are very much pointed towards this hate legislation as opposed to the other things. I don't think anybody, any serious observer or commentator to do with crime and security knows the points that you're making stand, and they are accurate. Gender-based violence, domestic violence in particular, especially since the pandemic. But as the key political leader in justice, you know, when you've had a really nasty assault on our streets at a peak tourist time, you need a grand gesture as well, and you need to put boots on the ground. It's you can do both. Exactly. You can follow up on both, and I think that's where she appears to be lacking. Yeah. And then, unfortunately, people are zeroing in on things.
There was millions given for overtime in that part of the city to put extra guards on the ground. We did have a walkabout, and we had
walkabouts don't cut it. Could I come back to a point though? It's about how you spend the money, and it's about how you deploy those boots on the ground. And I'll come back to a county man of yours, Brendan. Retired Assistant Commissioner Pat Leahy talked at length about the nature of policing. And Pat himself put together a concept called SAPS, Small Area Policing Strategy. And that empowered individual Gardaí who were selected specially or who could volunteer for this, who would be given a small area to concentrate on within the city, within the inner city. And he instituted that at a time when there was a lot of a huge diminishment in security because of the Hutch Kinahan war going on in north inner city Dublin. And it made a difference. And it made a difference because you had relationship building. Basically. Just a brief example of it would be you had an individual uniformed Garda who would be given lots of intelligence and information that would be usually above their pay grade. So they'd know intimately everything that was happening. And they would be expected to build relationships. If old Mrs. Murphy down at the end of a terrace was complaining that the rubbish wasn't being picked up, that Garda would be expected to get on to the local authorities about it. Stuff that wouldn't be typically policing tasks. So the relationship would be strong between the locality and the police.
So this is what we would know as community policing, which apparently there was a diminishment of it.
And now senior management of the Gardaí dismissed those concepts and say, well, we're all community police officers. And if you talk to police officers on the ground, one individual I know who polices in the south of the country, and he's coming near his retirement now, he made a comment to me once. He said, you're going to get the police you deserve now, because he was more or less saying that putting in these policies was strangling the individual Garda's discretion and putting them at a desk where he gave me an example once. He is a local Garda. He knows his locality intimately. There were cars stolen. He got the call about it. Within a few phone calls, he discovered where they were. He discovered who did it. He had it sorted out. And then he started to get trouble from his headquarters as to, did you do the local canvas? Have you filled out the forms? No, I haven't. I've solved the crime. Will that do? And no, you do need systems as well. We've seen a happy medium.
We've seen in the Guards like that, you know, that people's discretion and all that,
and it can get abused. It has been abused, and I'm not denying that. But what I'm saying is that maybe, and John Mooney has a piece where he's analysing the tenure of the current commission in the Sunday Times, whereby the rank and file Gardaí and upper echelons, they've been dissatisfied with Drew Harris for a while. Now, part of it is just unbridled anti-Northern sentiment, and they'd want to get over it. I think Drew Harris has been a great example of a commissioner who's good on national security. But I think he's very focused on new systems, and we're kind of throwing out the baby with the bathwater.
Well, it was the job he was brought in to do. Yes, Sarah.
But we need to be mindful of the nature of the jurisdiction, and we need to adapt these systems that are important to. We need to hibernicise them.
Yeah. And I suppose you do need. A local guard needs people to talk to him and tell him stuff,
and that needs to be valued.
It was always
that
the way.
That ability of a local
guard. Sarah, briefly before we leave this, you picked a related piece here. Knights Are faces tough tasks to clean up the city. This is
Dublin City Council is going to appoint a new economic advisor tasked with revitalising life in Dublin City after 7 p.m. And they're talking about having a committee where you'd have Gardaí in the committee. And I'm thinking, what's the point? Because what power are they going to have? So I'll meet my friends in Dublin to get my bus home to Enfield from the Keys, Aston Quay. The last CityLink bus is at 10 p.m. that I can actually book a seat on. After that, I'm at the mercy of Bus Aaron, who'll rock up at 10:30, tell me, sorry love, the bus is full, I'm left standing on the side of the street in the rain because it's summer in Ireland, and I have to pay €100 to get a taxi home. And like, that's the nighttime economy.
Okay, but they are talking about bringing the stakeholders together.
They won't have executive power over scheduling buses. For me to feel safe on Aston Quay, I don't walk down there by myself anymore. Like if I'm out, you know, with my friends who are men, I make somebody walk me down there. Like that's the reality of the nighttime economy. And I don't see how an official in Dublin City Council is going to have executive power to change any of that in the same way that people talk about electing a mayor. But what's the point in electing a mayor if they don't actually have the power in anything, Sarah?
Like they are trying to say, let's bring together law enforcement, let's bring together transport, let's bring together everybody who has a role to play in this and let's get them talking.
Unless you change the systems, and we're talking about joining the dots, and unless you have a situation where the city authority has actual executive power over all the elements in the city, I can't see it doing much.
I don't necessarily disagree in terms of the power and so on that they need to be able to make those decisions. But I think back to Carlo, and I'm bringing this back now, but Raise and Give Week that we used to organise, Rag Week as it would be known. We used to have meetings.
Is that what Rag Week stands for? Raise and Give Week?
It's all about charity. Fred, it's all about charity.
I thought it was the fact that everyone was in flitters by the end of it.
Well, there's probably a bit of that too. But no, in fairness, it is about raising money for causes. But and does do that as well.
Are you sure they haven't retrofitted?
I can promise you. I dealt with the media at the time, but no, honestly, it is the in advance of that, back in Carlow, like there was years prior, there had been real challenges there around what happened around Rag Week and so on. So we brought together all those stakeholders. We brought together the residents. We brought together the college. We brought together the students, the publicans, the taxis, the chippers, all of those people.
Yeah.
Who had a part to play in the conversation or who were going to be involved in it. They didn't have the power to make all the decisions around how things would operate, but they had the opportunity to build a plan potentially or input into the plan that could make it more of a success for everyone in terms of raising
money. Do you know what I think you're talking about, Lorna? Cool. Joined up thinking. That's just, the country needs more of it. We'll take a break. Lorna Fitzpatrick, Kieran Casey, Sarah Carey and Declan Power staying with us.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel is still with us. Lorna Fitzpatrick, Kieran Casey, Sarah Carey and Declan Power. Kieran Casey, you have picked the front page of the Sunday Independent, and this is based on an Ireland Thinks poll that they have today. It's a piece by Jodie Cochrane and Hugh O'Connell. Prospects for SFFF coalition boosted by latest poll.
Yeah, I suppose, and it comes back to, I mean, it's the same kind of theme that, so all three leaders in government are going to be looking at this very, very hard, and that will form, you know, all fiscal policy for the next 2 years. What's happening, and I just did a book last year in the Department of Finance, the two finance ministers are going to be in scrapping out against everyone else at the cabinet table who all want to chuck money at their own departments. And there's a real problem that's going to shape all the things we're talking about that we should be investing, that we should be doing, are going to come secondary to this, because all the leaders are going to be looking at this going, this is what. And ultimately, what matters most, the Minister for Finance can't fire people. You need the party leaders to take ownership and kind of do the right thing. And the problem is they know they won't get rewarded for it. I mean, that's the problem for me.
So you're pointing to the problem of short-termism and
democracy. Yeah, well, like that, and institutionally, there's a real problem with that. And people will talk about, it'll all get framed as like, this was a generous budget or this was not a generous budget. It's like, grow up, it's our money. You know, it's not a generous budget, or it'll be framed as the Department of Finance got one over on the minister or something. Like, that's, I mean, it's child's, like, there's, you know, we've got a fiscal advisory council and it's saying you're spending too much current spending. They're saying you're not investing enough in capital infrastructure. We do this all the time. So like the housing problem is, you know, shortfall of capital spending over the last 15 years. This was, I was in the car coming home from a conference chatting to a colleague in 2013, and we were going, there's a spike in housing prices and it's because there's not enough housing. And the way you do it, you get in early and you go, what's our plan for this long term?
They would argue there was no money available at the time.
The problem was, again, it's down to forecasting. It's down to like, everyone was in the media talking about how Ireland was doomed for the next 20 years. No one really anticipated how quickly it was going to bounce back.
In fact, what was being talked about a lot as well was that we had way too many houses, wasn't it? I know a lot of them in the wrong place, but there was nothing supposed to be built for decades.
And that's the problem. It's not evidence-based. What you need, if you go and look at it, housing construction fell. So the peak of the boom was 93,000. It fell to about kind of 5,000 for a couple of years during the boom. People have different forecasts. It should be up 35, 50. And there's a massive lag getting back up to that. So the parties come out. So Owen O'Brien came out the other day and he said, we'll do it in 5 years. It's like, show me the plan. You know, and there is no plan. None of the political parties have any kind of plan of how you do this. The way to do it...
Well, the government has a wide panoply of schemes that are all progressing.
all being thrown in one after the other.
But I suppose you can't build all the houses straight away.
No,
like,
that's
can you?
But
like,
that's
we have capacity.
Of course, that's exactly the point. But it is...
So we are now, as you say, we are now suffering from the misguided thinking of the past.
Absolutely.
But it does feel as if... We're doing it as quickly as we can.
Yeah, of course. But the problem is, you think about it, don't think about it in terms of, okay, how do we get back up to 50,000 houses again built per year and then crash it again? It's like, okay, well, what's the long term strategy? We don't have the construction workers. What do you do about that? And the solution the last time was, we'll import 100,000 Eastern Europeans. We'll push the pedal to the metal. We'll crash the economy. They'll all go home. And we'll introduce. So coming up to an election again, if it's like, okay, well, we'll chuck all the money at current spending. We'll underspend by 15% in capital. And all of these issues that we're talking about are all interconnected in that. It's capital spending. It's long-term planning. It's someone coming up with a plan, which we have never come up with a decent economic or social plan in Ireland, ever.
Lorna, you picked it. There's a related piece here in the Mail on Sunday by John Drennan. McGrath says he won't forget prudence and splash the 48 billion cash. So... He's claiming he is going to be prudent. And then you've other people, unnamed people, saying we don't need Pascal Mark II. Prudence doesn't butter any parsnips with the voters. So it's kind of to what Kieran is saying, isn't
absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. And it 100% builds on what Kieran is saying there in terms of having that, I suppose, plan for the future and future-proofing it. But what I found interesting is there was a Fianna Fáil source in that piece saying that a savings plan for some future Sinn Féin government to spend won't get much applause at the Fianna Fáil think-in in September. And again, I think that just brings back the narrow thought process around this. Rather than thinking into the future, rather than investing in those capital projects that we require, be that health, be it housing, be it education, whatever it is, we're talking about that kind of potential giveaway budget and that's what will, you know, be in the fore of people's minds whenever we come to a general election next.
Okay, the real politics, Sarah, you can see people's points if they want to get re-elected and they're thinking, what? Who's saving a load of money so that I lose my seat and then Sinn Féin get a bonanza four or five years in power?
I know. The problem, of course, is the electorate, not the politicians, because what are they going to vote for? Personally, look, I wrote about this a couple of weeks ago and the point I was making was, you can spend that money, give another fiver on the pension. I woke up last September, I had just paid my son's college fees, which I had saved up for because I knew I was going to have to pay them. And suddenly it was announced we were all getting a grand back, which I hadn't been expecting. You can do things like that, but does it actually work? And I don't think it does work anymore. I think people just pocket the money and don't shift their views and are still going to vote for Sinn Féin, largely because they just want to change, you know? Like, there is a big just sick of seeing the same people there. So that maybe if you took the higher road and didn't do these silly payoffs, you know, that people aren't going to vote for you anyway, at least you'd leave something decent behind you so you could hold your head up, you know?
I would say, and I agree, but I think there's, you know, there is people who are absolutely struggling right now and that needs to be addressed as part of this budget, you know what I mean? So,
but how do you identify them? It's the universal giveaways that are irritating. Like, if you can identify the people who really need
exactly.
And we have great data on that. The CSO are like, you know, it's single parents, it's parents with young children.
Disability. People with a disability.
And it's not going to be the people who get the extra money. The people who get the extra money are going to be voting blocks like pensioners who actually are living in much lower levels of poverty than the general population.
Pensioners are the group in society at least risk of poverty, and they still manage to come out every time and play this poor card and get the money every time.
Yeah, but you can't blame
them. I thought the airport broke the text machine. somebody better get working there on pulling in some text from the pensioners. Sorry, Declan,
could I add a point, though, in terms of what Kieran was saying about, you know, and everybody has been saying, lack of planning and lack of foresight. I think one of the things that... it acts as an impediment with the solving problems and moving forward is a type of squeamishness with regards to decision making and perhaps at the upper echelon in the various departments, a lack of decision making capacity in adversity and in crisis, which is a skill set of its own right. And I think our senior civil servants need to look outside maybe of the departments for that kind of capacity. And a couple of examples that come to mind, like modular housing seems to be a useful tool to me to help in the immediate address problems, at the very least to address problems with the refugee overflow. I wouldn't see anybody complaining about it. But then other things come to mind. Like
Modular houses, hundreds of them have come on stream now and are coming on stream. And you don't magic up a modular house.
I agree. But we seem to be a bit slow kind of think to it. At the start of the war in Ukraine, I think there was a genuine belief in the upper echelons in this country, this will be over by Christmas kind of thing. And that, if you looked with a little bit of depth of analysis and looked at the geopolitical situation, that wasn't going to be the case. But I look at my hometown, where we have a military barracks that's not occupied anymore as a military barracks, and it's been used for refugees, and the refugees were being housed on the square in temporary accommodation. That barracks had been done up with significant injection of state money back during 2008, I think it was. Why were the barrack blocks not fit to be used? Why could the hospital down on Baggot Street not be used?
They went and looked at the hospital on Baggot Street and it was not worth doing up. There's been a lot of talk about it.
Hold on a second. What does that mean?
Once they actually looked at it, it would have cost... It wouldn't have been cost effective at all
when we're in an emergency.
Much bigger job.
Yeah, but my broader point is this.
But then if you put somebody into a building that was unsafe or whatever, there'd be holy war as well.
But this is my point.
Let me make the point. It's easy for us to sit here
that's what we're here for.
Generalities.
Yeah, but hold on. If you just let me make...
I shouldn't have bitten the hand that fed.
But Brendan, just let me finish this point because it's quite relevant. When you're in an emergency, good enough is what you look for, not excellence. And I think what's happening is our senior decision makers are, understandably so, in a peacetime scenario, it would be fine. They're looking at the letter of the law, they're looking at EU guidelines and directives, and if it doesn't meet those, then they're kicking it to touch. You're in an emergency, you look at what you need for the immediate, the interim, and your long-term planning. And we're not doing enough of the immediate, and we're irritating people, we're missing opportunities, because we're being squeamish about it. That's my point.
Yeah, okay. But I would just make the point as well that when they did try and move fast on things, right, people complained about not being communicated with, not being that word consulted with about
and
refugees
you face
being
that
put in.
Down, so, you know, Brendan, that's what government is. You make a decision, and if it's a good decision, you stick by your decision. You don't panic because some people complain about it. Yeah, that's governance.
And it was lack of a simple communication plan.
Okay, easier said than done. Mm. I'll read a couple of pensioners.
Are they from my parents?
People living on state pension are not well off. I don't think that's the point that Sarah was making. Brendan, someone on your show said pensioners are at the least risk of poverty. Yeah. That's simply not true, Jen.
They're half as likely to be living in poverty as the rest of the population. Yeah.
And they own all the property.
If you look at wealth, it's going to be even more striking than income. It's just not true. And I mean, again, this is exactly what Sarah's talking about. It's over-responsiveness to the squeaky wheel. And then you leave people who are in actual poverty. Of course there are pensioners in poverty. So there's no point in someone texting
10%.
You going, I am in poverty and therefore your point is wrong. The general point is right. So you find the people who are actually living in poverty and you direct it at them. You don't give an across-the-board payment to the group who across society are actually the best off.
The people with the lowest incomes have a disability and the group at most risk of poverty are children. Mm-hmm. That's the reality.
And it's a multiple of
the texter says, I absolutely agree. The pensioners are by and large not struggling as much as young families on middle incomes. Yeah. I would be quite happy to forego a pension increase if genuinely poorer families
Here's the really
interesting
thing, Brendan. The ESRI, the longitudinal survey, mm-hmm. Ciarán, Tilda, they did a study on that about 5 or 6 years ago. And older people in Ireland, about half of the people in the cohort were directly giving money or, say, doing a shop or something like that to their adult children. And that's why there isn't as much political conflict about this, because adult children don't want to see their parents have money taken away from them, mm-hmm. because actually they're the ones who are going to get that money directly.
So what it does is it's just distributive thing is it means that the people who have the good taste to have rich parents do well because they get the money and the money can be transferred to them. Whereas, I mean, it's just an awful way to run a system. Again, it's funny. I think it's a great point what Sarah was saying about the people. I think maybe we're being too harsh on the electorate. I don't think people necessarily want the fiver. I think they want a long-term plan to solutions. And I think if the centre parties could come out and say, here's our plan, like Ireland 2050, 2060, here's what we're going to do with the economy, social, housing, environment, climate change. And I think people would really respond to that.
And one final point on that, Gary Murphy's column in the Sunday Times today is very good. He has a little cut at Justin Barrett saying he has all the charisma off a stamp. But the larger question he's asking, is there an appetite for a far-right politics in Ireland? And the answer very clearly is no. The centre has held. And for all that Ireland Thinks poll showing that Sinn Féin are on 34%, the government would still actually get back in tomorrow. Like, they still do have a majority.
Okay, now that you've said that, I just need to give the state of the parties. Sinn Féin up 3 at 34%. Fine Gael, no change at 19%. Fianna Fáil, 18%, down 1. Social Democrats, down 1 at 5%. Green Party, 5%, up 2. It's a weather for ducks and the Green Party, you could say. Labour up 2 at 4%. Solidarity, People Before Profit, down 1 at 3%. ANU down 1 at 2%. Independents and Others are down 3 at 10%. And that that poll was text-based, conducted on Friday and Saturday, August the 4th and the 5th. The sample size was 1,272 and the margin was 2.8%. So that is what your one minor comment cost me there, Sarah Carey. And now I have to take a break.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel still with us. Lorna Fitzpatrick, Kieran Casey, Sarah Carey and Declan Power. There's two things I want to get to know, and we have about 4 minutes. Kieran, could you just tell me a little bit about Accenture? You used to work there as well. You picked out a piece today in the Business Post by Donald McNamee. But what's your read on what's going on there? Because what we're hearing is that a lot of these jobs are actually being outsourced to poorer countries as against...
They were doing that anyway. So I worked there a couple of years ago. I was running a research team and we were in... they'll have offsite offices. What happens is that the big multinationals they want to be able to hire people and they don't want to put them the average tech salaries. So they hire people in to do content moderation and things like that. And it's a really grueling, difficult job. And these people are paid very kind of very low salaries by comparison to the rest of the tech sector. So they're people I'd feel very sorry for losing their jobs off the back of this. I mean, the tech sector is very hard to feel that sorry for people who are losing jobs in a multiple of your earnings. But these people, they've been doing very difficult jobs and they're being let go in the middle of all this. I think, again, it's by and large, from looking at it, it's in the operation side. It's not consultants.
So these are not highly paid.
No, not at all. No, I mean, no, they'd be on much lower incomes. A lot of them would be non-native Irish. They come in and, I mean, they're doing difficult work. And definitely, I mean, there's talk about, the state agencies will help find them jobs. I mean, the good thing is that we're at 4% unemployment. They'll find, hopefully, the vast majority will find jobs. But I'd feel very sorry for them. They're not like your typical tech worker on a multiple of the average industrial wage. So probably a lot of them are below it.
Yeah. Someone pointed out to me the irony of all these tech bosses saying, so we accidentally overhired there during the pandemic, right? So the boss is saying, I made a big strategic error there. I'm not going to lose my job, though. All the people we overheard are losing theirs. Declan, I want to finish up on a piece you've picked from the piece about the Alzheimer's drug. Where is it? It's in the Sunday Times by Ben Spencer. Yeah. This is very, very good news, isn't it?
It is, It's talking in figures of up to 90% of a rollback, for people that are in the early stages of it. Obviously, these things are in the early stages, but they give us great hope. I mean, my own father suffers from dementia, and it's been a slow, drawn-out process for him, largely because he responded well to medication. But it's not a pleasant disease.
Okay, so all it did was slow it down for him a little bit. Did it give him a bit more quality time in his
life? Because a person can still have a good, if they're physically healthy, if they're able to still engage a little bit with those around them. But it's also about those around them. So their families can still you still have that person in your life in a real time way. And I think news like that gives people who are diagnosed hope that no more than cancer sufferers can be told your condition can be managed, it can be medicated, which has been a game changer. And this to me seems like a form of targeted therapy, because what it works on, it's about gene mapping and gene analysis. So some people are more prone to certain things, some people therefore will respond better to certain types of medicine. So it's getting much more focused. We talk in the military, you know, world about smart munitions. You know, these are smart medicines that can target based on your genetic structure and give you opportunities if you've got the right structure, that can be a game changer for your life.
Yeah, absolutely. Listen, we give out about big pharma, late stage capitalism, all the ills of it and everything, like cancer treatment transformed in the last yes. decade or two. And it does feel like in another decade that Alzheimer's treatment is going to be transformed, doesn't it? Like, I mean, look, we've talked a lot here today about lack of joined up thinking, how long it takes to do everything. Don't we live in incredible times in other ways?
But in the space of 2 years, there's been huge jumps in pharmacology, particularly with regards to cancer treatments and things like that. There are people that are having not just lives, but quality lives because of that.
And actually, that's a big thing to remember in society. The quality of our lives now is so vastly improved on what it was even 20, 30 years ago. And, you know, you always get, you're vulnerable to being slagged off for being insensitive to people who are having a hard time. But even poorer people now are still vastly richer than they were 25 years ago. And in Ireland, they're vastly richer than they are in many other countries.
On that happy note, we will end our panel today. Lorna Fitzpatrick, account manager at the public affairs consultancy Instinctive Partners and a member of the Labour Party. Kieran Casey, lecturer in economics at the University of Limerick. Sarah Carey, communications consultant and Irish Independent columnist, and Declan Power, security and defence analyst. Thank you all very much.